Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with Nick Turse. Nick Turse is the author of a book called The Complex, which is not what we're talking about tonight. His latest book is called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. He's managing editor of TomDispatch.com and a fellow at the Nation Institute, writes for many magazines, but this particular book is one that says that the My Lai Massacre, which was famous in history, was not the only massacre that took place in Vietnam. As a matter of fact, in many parts of Vietnam during the war, it was commonplace. It affected our country, it affected Vietnam, affect the way we look at war, period, and human lives. And for this book, Turse won the Reidenauer Prize for Repertorial Distinction, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and a fellowship at Harvard University's Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. And here's our conversation with the award-winning Nick Turse. Well, welcome, Nick Turse. Good to have you on the show with us.
Well, thanks very much for having me on.
I've been looking forward to reading this book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Let's just start with a simple question and a very not simple subject. After 30,000 or so books have been written since the war itself was fought in the 60s, tell me what led you to this. I mean, you're of the generation down. So what led you to go back to this?
Well, you know, I kind of stumbled into this project in one respect, and I can certainly tell you that story. But the reason why I ended up writing this book when, as you say, there have been 30,000 others on the war is that I looked over the literature and, you know, I really found one thing to be lacking. I didn't see a book that really told the complete story of what I came to understand as the signature aspect of the conflict, and that's the Vietnamese civilian suffering. You know, millions of Vietnamese were killed or wounded or made refugees due to deliberate U.S. policies, like the use of almost unrestrained bombing and artillery shelling across wide swaths of the countryside, deliberate policies dictated at the highest levels of the U.S. military. But you know, when I looked out onto the literature and read, you know, great books that have been written on the war, but the problem was it always seemed to me that Vietnamese were, in most cases, you know, bit characters that the Americans, not surprisingly, take the front and center position in American histories of the war, and that the suffering of the Vietnamese, the people that experienced the war every day for, you know, up to 10 years, just seemed to be largely absent.
There was one person in your book several people in the book you spent a great deal of time talking about. And one of those people is Jamie Henry and the whole world around the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group that you spend a great deal of time kind of exploring. Did before you talk a bit about Jamie Henry, the Doc Henry, the medic, who kind of was horrified by what happened around him. How much did that influence this writing of the book, finding him? Or did the writing of the book come before finding Jamie Henry?
No, you know, Jamie really affected my life in a lot of ways. And it was his, you know, the case file for his case, it really put the hook in me, as it were. And really drove me towards this project. And I discovered this group of records in the National Archives called the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group. And there were hundreds and hundreds of reports generally from active duty GIs or recently returned veterans attesting to atrocities, things like massacres, murders, rapes, assault, torture, mutilation, you know, just horrific crimes. But Jamie's case file really... it really had an impact on me. For one, it was you know, extremely well investigated. Army criminal investigators spent years going over his case, so it was in some ways atypically large. But you know, Jamie just impressed me so much as a man reading on paper that you know, I knew I'd have to track him down. And when I did, I was even more more impressed and more struck by the ins and outs of the investigation that he kicked off.
Well, talk a bit about that. I mean, I think that, sure. First of all, let's just take a step back. Talk about this Vietnam War Crimes Working Group and the things you discovered as you began to explore this kind of group that really didn't do a great deal with what they found at all, but really kind of... You found things in there that multiplied My Lai, and this is where you find Jamie Henry. So, talk a bit about that sojourn through the War Crimes Working Group archives.
Sure, you know, as I kind of mentioned, I stumbled upon these records. I was down at the National Archives doing a very different type of Vietnam War research. I was when I was a graduate student, I worked on a project on post-traumatic stress disorder among U.S. Vietnam veterans. And I would go down to the archives and try and find hard records to match up with the self-report material that we had, what veterans said they were doing and where they were serving at the time. And I would use records to corroborate that. But on one of these trips, every research avenue that I pursued, it didn't pan out. I just hit dead end after dead end. And finally, I went to an archivist there and I said, look, I can't go back to my boss empty-handed. I'm going to need something, you know, some reason to come back here at least. And he thought about it for a second or two, and then he said, do you think that witnessing war crimes could cause post-traumatic stress? And I said, you know, I think that's an excellent hypothesis. What do you have on war crimes? And he said, well, we have these records called the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group. They've been sitting down in the basement for years.
And what year was this, by the way? I'm sorry, Nick, what year was this?
This was in 2001.
Okay, yeah, just wanted to set that straight. I'm sorry, go ahead. Didn't mean to interrupt you, go ahead.
And, you know, he said they'd just been sitting around. I said, why don't you pull those for me? And within an hour, I was going through, you know, box after box of, you know, to say this was a treasure trove of information is the wrong phrase. It
right.
was a horror trove.
As you wrote about, yes, right.
Yeah, and as I said, a massacre, murder, rape, torture, mutilation, all these crimes, reports from American veterans of active duty GIs, and it really told a horrifying story. And what I came to learn was that this War Crimes Working Group was set up in the Pentagon in the wake of the My Lai massacre, which took place in 1968. 500 Vietnamese civilians were killed over a period of 4 hours by American GIs. And the military was really shocked by the revelation of My Lai, the fact that it became public knowledge and it was really a powder keg. And they resolved never to let this happen again. So General William Westmoreland, who at the time was the Army Chief of Staff and just a couple years earlier had been the Supreme Commander in Vietnam, he set up this group of colonels to keep tabs on all war crimes allegations that popped up. Anything that Army Criminal Investigation Command was looking at, anything that bubbled up into the press, and the idea was that they would never be caught flat-footed again, and whenever possible, they would work actively to tamp down allegations. And in many cases, they did just bury these records away, including Jamie Henry's file. So, you know, getting back to him, you know, Jamie Henry was a self-described hippie living in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district before the war. But he was drafted, and he became a medic, and by all accounts, he was an exceptionally good one. He saved a lot of American lives. Members of his unit continually lauded his efforts. But what Jamie saw in Vietnam really shocked him. You know, he told me that on his first day in the field, he watched as the point man, the lead man in his patrol, detained a young girl and molested her. And he thought to himself, you know, my God, what's going on here? And over the ensuing months, he watched a litany of atrocities take place. A young boy who was executed for no reason, an old man used for target practice, a prisoner who was beaten up and thrown off a cliff, a man who was held down to be run over by an armored personnel carrier, basically a small tank. But when Jamie spoke up about brutality, his life was threatened by other members of the unit. And even his friends came up to him after and said, you know, look, Doc, you know, all medics were called Doc.
Right.
Look, Doc, you need to shut your mouth or you're going to get shot in the back during a firefight and nobody's going to be the wiser. So Jamie did keep his mouth shut. But he kept his eyes open, and he kept cataloging everything that he saw. And the culmination of this was February 8th, 1968. His unit went into a small hamlet, and they rounded up all the civilians there, about 20 women and children. And Jamie was taking a break. He sat down to smoke a cigarette, and he heard an order from his commanding officer, a West Point trained captain, come over the radio. And the order was to kill anything that moves. So Jamie hears this, and he hops up, and he starts making his way towards the captain because he wants to intervene He was afraid that this really would happen. But he was just seconds late. As he arrived on the scene, he watched as five men opened up on full automatic with their M16 rifles. And they gunned down these 19 or 20 women and children. And Jamie told me that 30 seconds after this took place, that he vowed that he would blow the whistle on it. And he was true to his word. He came home, and he reported it to an Army lawyer, who told him to keep quiet because there were a million ways that the Army could make him disappear. He went and talked to an Army criminal investigator, but that man threatened him. He went and sought out a civilian lawyer for advice, and this man told him to get some political backing. So he wrote to a few congressmen, but nobody returned his letters. So then he decided to go public, and he spoke out with other anti-war veterans at public forums. He went on the radio, published an article, held a press conference, but he just couldn't get any traction, and eventually he gave up. And it was only after, really, that I showed up on his doorstep with several phone book-sized stacks of records that he knew that the Army actually conducted a thorough investigation. They corroborated everything he'd said, and the records actually painted an even grimmer picture because other members of the unit saw things that even Jamie hadn't. So this was a very detailed investigation. The Army determined that 30 charges could be brought against soldiers who had served in that unit for crimes they'd committed. But the Army never charged anyone. They never convened a court-martial. And, of course, no one was ever convicted. And what would have been actually the first story about a My Lai-style massacre wasn't exposed until 40 years after the fact. This case was totally buried and just sat in the archives until I found it.
Well, it makes me think of something later in the book when you talk about Westmoreland and Razor putting General William Pierce, who is head of the 4th Infantry in Nam that fought in the Central Highlands, behind this army inquiry into My Lai. And it's interesting how you put it. You write, the work was meant to give the appearance that the military was taking decisive action. Few people realized, though, that Pierce's much-publicized inquiry was only supposed to explore the Army's inadequate early investigation of the massacre of My Lai and subsequent cover-up, not the killings themselves. And the scope of the investigation, as the quote, does not include ongoing criminal investigations in progress. And so whether it was that or whether it was the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group, I mean, people looked into these things, but not with the aim of doing anything about them.
It was
almost as if they were trying to get this information so they could contain it and so it wouldn't explode.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think this was really, it was a public relations effort and a means to control the narrative of the war. But the War Crimes Working Group definitely was never devoted to exposing war crimes, to preventing war crimes, to getting guidance into the field in any way. I spoke to some members of the War Crimes Working Group, in the course of preparing this book, and one of them, who really sticks in my mind is the general with the by the name John, General John John.
Right.
And he told me that at the time, he was in the Pentagon. He oversaw these records, and he thought it was right to keep it a secret. He thought that this would damage the war effort, that it was his job to keep these records under wraps. But in the years since, and especially after the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and atrocity scandals like Abu Ghraib, he came to see it as a real mistake, and he thought that if these had been exposed at the time, if atrocities had a real airing in public and people had understood what had gone on, then maybe the military would have taken steps to actually change its training. Maybe this would become part of military history and it'd be something that could be avoided in the present, in the future. So he came to see it as a major mistake, and at the time, he thought he was doing the right thing.
And it's also the things that you document, the stories. I mean, I remember Well, the general you talk about a lot in this book, Julian Ewell, who commanded the troops down in the Mekong Delta, and his Speedy Express. You know, had Julian Ewell been a, and you can describe who he was and what you discovered, and I'll come back with some questions about it. But it's the place where Hegel fought, who may be our next Secretary of Defense, just before he took over. It's the same place that Kerry fought in the Delta. But this particular guy, if he had been a Nazi general in World War II, he would have been at Nuremberg.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and it's one that Robert McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense during the war, you know, in the documentary Fog of War, he
yes,
says
right.
much the same that if we had been the losers. Now, of course, the U.S. didn't win the Vietnam War, but they came out of it relatively unscathed as the most powerful military in the world. But you know the point still holds that. If the U.S. was in the position that that Nazi Germany or Imperial Japan had been post World War II, then he said I certainly would have been tried as a war criminal, and I think that's probably right.
So talk a bit about Ewell. Talk a bit about this Speedy Express.
Sure.
It's something we don't know about them. I mean, the Mekong Delta was this thickly settled area. I mean, it was one of the most difficult places for anybody to fight in, but talk a bit about this Ewell and this Speedy Express.
Sure. Julian Ewell was a World War II hero who then sort of bottled up in Washington, either at the Pentagon or as a White House attaché. For most of the post-war period before Vietnam, he was just in desk jobs, and he finally got his chance at a combat command. And I think he resolved to make the most of it. You know, and move up the chain of command. And Julian Ewell would never speak to me. I did show up on his doorstep, but he wasn't prepared
talk.
To talk. But you know, Ewell took over in the Mekong Delta in just after the 1968 Tet Offensive, and he decided to really take the gloves off. And the war was run on the premise of body count, that you had to turn in a large enemy body count.
And that came from the top. They came from Westmoreland, the White House, the Defense Secretary. They came from the top.
That's right. They were fighting an attrition strategy in Vietnam. The idea was to kill more enemy than they could put into the field, and eventually the enemy would just give up. They would see it as, they had more debits than credits in their ledger sheet. This is the way that Robert McNamara fought the war, like it was a business. And this was his idea, and because the U.S. wasn't trying to generally take territory or try and take an enemy capital, they were looking for a metric, and they settled on body count. So basically, you had to kill your way to victory. And very early in the war, it became apparent that U.S. commanders didn't care really about who those bodies belonged to. It just about any body would do. And Ewell became, especially notorious for body count. And if you you talk to or read the testimony of the men who served under him, colonels who headed his battalion, they say that he was fanatic. That he was, that he constantly pressed them for body count. And even within the military, he became known as the butcher of the Mekong Delta. This was the type of mindset. He just wanted bodies. So over the course of 1968, Ewell really freed the hands of the men under his command. He demanded bodies, and he made it easier and easier to unleash heavy firepower on the countryside of the Mekong Delta, which was the rice bowl of South Vietnam and an exceptionally densely populated area. So this was, it was very dangerous to do so. And he ended up killing a lot of Vietnamese along the way, but in the fall of '68, things got even worse. Lyndon Johnson decided to make another run at peace talks in Paris. His vice president was in the midst of a presidential campaign, and he saw this as a way to help out the effort. And you know, the idea was now that the U.S. had to get the Mekong Delta into South Vietnamese hands, South Vietnamese allies' control before peace could break out. So they really took, you know, whatever handcuffs might have been on Ewell before were released. And in December of 1968, he kicked off Operation Speedy Express, which ran until the end of May in 1969. And during this operation, Ewell just put up these incredibly high body counts, where the U.S. would be killing, you know, hundreds of Vietnamese enemies a week at the cost of almost no U.S. lives, and they were producing very few enemy weapons. They seemed to never recover weapons after these big so-called battles. And at the end of Speedy Express, they claimed an enemy body count of about 11,000, but only recovered 748 weapons. Now, this was... glaring anomalies like this showed up in the records a lot, but very few people looked into them. But in the case of Speedy Express, the killing had been so great in the Delta that U.S. advisors had spoken out to the press about it, and a little bit of word leaked out that way. And then a couple years after Speedy Express, a very gifted stringer for Newsweek magazine, named Alex Shimkin,
right,
started looking at the records, and he noticed that something looked really amiss. There was really something wrong here. And he started compiling evidence, and he brought it to his bureau chief, Kevin Buckley.
At Newsweek.
And Buckley, looked at what Shimkin had brought him, and he realized very fast that this was a big story. So the two of them set out to figure out what had happened in the Mekong Delta during Speedy Express. And they went down to the Delta. They talked to Vietnamese witnesses and survivors. They talked to members of the South Vietnamese government who had seen this firsthand, U.S. advisors, U.S. military personnel who served with the 9th Division, and all of them seemed to be telling the same story, that they also found when they looked at hospital records in the Delta, that tremendous numbers of civilians had been killed. And Buckley and Shimkin came up with an estimate of up to 5,000 civilians as the death toll for Speedy Express. And they tried to, they wrote up an extremely detailed article, something around, 8,000 words. And it was really damning. I mean, it was the stuff of Pulitzer Prizes and congressional investigations. But this report kind of just foundered at Newsweek. And the Newsweek editors kept pushing back on it. And eventually, they got a reason why. And Newsweek thought that the army and the White House had gone through so much because of the My Lai massacre that had been so tough on them that they didn't feel right subjecting them to another big atrocity scandal. So they cut the Buckley and Shimkin piece down to 1,800 words, and it created only a ripple of interest, and then it just kind of faded away. But what Buckley and Shimkin didn't know is that an internal whistleblower had told the military the full story of Speedy Express a couple years before, just after it had taken place, and that the military actually conducted its own investigation of Speedy Express, and the Inspector General's office determined that the Newsweek estimate of 5,000 civilian dead was actually a low-end estimate. The military's own estimate said that up to 7,000 civilians had been killed at My Lai. During Speedy Express.
Yeah, Speedy Express in the Delta.
Right, and this is a body count of more than 10 times the number that were killed at My Lai. So we're talking about, industrial-scale killing. But, of course, the military kept it quiet. Newsweek, helped to suppress their own investigation. And this, the full story, just faded away.
I guess what blew my mind about your book is what you describe, this kind of confluence of events you're talking about that you've just finished talking about together, which is I've been dealing with Vietnam for most of my life,
sure,
for the last 47 years, and so the idea of all the investigations that took place inside the Department of Defense, that they knew these things were going on and kept them quiet, didn't act on them, and I didn't know the story about how Newsweek had kind of suppressed the story as well. But that confluence of what some of the media did in its coverage and Walter Cronkite and others notwithstanding, and what these reports were that kind of squelched the kind of massive killings that took place, that's pretty mind-boggling. I mean, that's pretty intense. It kind of speaks to our worst fears about what government can do to suppress the truth.
Yeah, it's I mean, it's a really a frightening prospect, and I kept finding this, you know, it's really the same story that kept playing out again and again when you looked at the records. I mean, the U.S. was trying to, you know, it wasn't able to keep the lid on My Lai, basically because of a very dedicated whistleblower named Ron Ridenour.
Right.
And an excellent investigative journalist, Seymour Hersh.
Right.
Still breaking stories today for The New Yorker.
Right, I love it. Yeah, he doesn't stop.
You know, so My Lai was the one that got out. And I have to say, in all honesty, My Lai was exceptional, you know, for two reasons. One, 500 civilians killed over a period of just 4 hours is an anomaly of sorts. There were many massacres in Vietnam, but few were this many civilians at one time. But the other anomaly is that that the military really dug into My Lai and really investigated it thoroughly, which is the only time it really put this type of effort into one atrocity to try and figure out what happened. And when they did, they really I think it really scared them because they found exactly what they didn't want to happen. What they wanted to show was that My Lai was an isolated incident, and it was carried out by a problem unit. And what they found was that their own investigation said that the men who made up the unit that carried out this massacre were a cross-section of American youth, that it was a very representative unit. What General Pierce found in his investigation was that on the same morning that My Lai was carried out, another unit in another village not very far away carried out its own massacre. And the massacre at My Kay, we'll never know exactly how many were killed there, but you know, some Americans on the scene said as many as 155 were killed that morning. The exact same time, but another unit in another village carrying out a massacre. And this is the first time that you ever really look into it, and this is what you find. I mean, I think it had to be devastating for the military, and they knew that they had, you know, something really hot on their hands, that this was a major problem for the war effort and for the military as an institution, and that these things had to be suppressed. Reports like this had to be suppressed at all costs.
We're going to take a very brief break and come back to continue our conversation with Nick Turse about his latest book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real War in Vietnam. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. For the fifth year in a row, Maryland's public schools have been named number one in the country by Education Week magazine. Visit MarylandEducators.org to explore what it means to invest in our students, school construction, and safety, and the educators' programs and services that make our schools a national leader. That's MarylandEducators.org. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're talking with Nick Turse, who his latest book is called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, winner of the Ridenour Prize for Repertorial Distinction. Ridenour, of course, being the of My Lai fame, and Vietnam vet, who was an amazing human being in his own right. He's also the author of The Complex, managing editor at TomDispatch.com, and a fellow at the Nation Institute, and joins us here today to talk about his book, Kill Anything That Moves. So, Nick, going back, picking up where we left off, I mean, there's so much here, and it also raised some other questions that I think have to be asked about all this. I mean, when I read the book, one of the things that the war was a very complex place, and not every soldier, not every unit, not everyone who fought there participated in atrocities. Everybody heard things or saw things or knew things were happening. But let's say, like, the 4th Infantry in the Central Highlands, where Homer Steedley, who we built the story Wandering Souls around, that when he, after 40 years, returned the books that belonged to a Vietnamese soldier, NVA man he killed, and finally found the family. We found the family, gave the stuff back to him, which is very moving. But I'm bringing him up because for two reasons. The first reason is that the 4th Industry that fought in the Central Highland, this was like they were fighting the North Vietnamese Army, the NVA. They weren't engaged in killing civilians. You know what I'm saying? I mean, so I think is there a danger in kind of making us fall back to not that saying that everything you've written is not true and needs to be told and people need to understand what we did in Vietnam. It has to be understood for our own souls and future. but the danger of coming back to the kind of notion in the 60s that all vets were baby killers. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Now, this is something that, you know, I you know, definitely want to make clear that, you know, in no way am I saying that, that you know, all U.S. troops carried out atrocities or all units. There were plenty of units that were fighting in areas, like you mentioned, in the Central Highlands, where they didn't run into large numbers of civilians, where they were fighting a uniformed enemy. And, you know, and also, you know, what I hope that I explain well in the book is that, you know, most Vietnamese were not killed by, you know, even ground patrols. They were
right.
not killed in massacres like My Lai or the one that Jamie Henry witnessed. Most Vietnamese civilians who died during the war were killed through the application of heavy firepower, through bombing, artillery shelling, you know, the use of helicopter gunships where they were allowed to just basically kill anything that moves, anyone running, or they would call it taking evasive action. You know, through the application of unrestrained firepower on the countryside, this is how most Vietnamese were killed or wounded. They weren't, you know, shot by, you know, murderous U.S. troops who were just looking to you know, mindlessly kill. You know, while there were plenty of micro-level atrocities, it's the, you know, what you might call macro-level ones that really caused the bulk of the suffering that Vietnamese civilians face.
And it also has to do with, I think, there's so many levels to this. It's so complex. And I'm really happy you wrote this book, and that because I think that America has to come to terms with Vietnam and terms with what happened there while my generation is still alive. And, you know, and that because I think that it's like the Civil War in a way. We can live this war for a long time to come. And it's affected our policy and who we are as a people, I think, in many ways. And, you know, it's like when you have – I was thinking about Homer Steedley and his command. And, you know, he said when he was in high school, and when he was at Clemson, he studied Nuremberg. And he could never do those things. He was in the same officer's candidate school as Callie. They were roommates. Mm. Or Ridenhour. You know, there were no – he didn't commit these atrocities in that same unit – when he was in charge of it, you know? I mean, so this there's something that is both twisted in American policy that allows these things to go on, but there's something about the kind of where certain men come from morally that allow or don't allow them to commit these acts. You know, I'm thinking of the documentary 4 Hours at My Lai. I mean, the book 4 Hours at My Lai, the documentary made out of it, Remember My Lai. And there was this guy in there, Earl Stanley. It was a black guy from the South. And really dirt poor. And Callie threatened to kind of court-martial him and some of charges because he wouldn't kill anybody there. And because he said simply, this is something decent people don't do. I mean, that kind of tear was all over the place.
Yeah, you know, you know, I think that, you know, if there are any heroes in my book, I mean, They are these Americans, men like Ron Ridenour or Jamie Henry or, you know, well, he's not in my book. You know, there were others at My Lai, like Hugh Thompson, the helicopter pilot who
right.
saved Vietnamese on the ground and told his crew members to train their guns on the Americans, that, you know, they were going to protect Vietnamese civilians there. So, you know, there are a lot of horrific stories, but there are a lot of heartening stories that come out of these horrific acts that really attest to the you know what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature that are in the best traditions of America.
And I guess what's also reading your book that kind of I think for a lot of people I've shared this book with several people, Wayne Carlin and others, to get their sense of it before you and I spoke together. And one of the things that your book kind of brings out, besides the horrendousness of the crimes that took place in Vietnam, many from the air with napalm and phosphorus and more, just burning people alive, and the things that happened there. That you mentioned John Paul Vann, and you can talk a bit about him in a moment. because he was deeply involved with keeping things quiet. But talk about him before I give you this quote from John Paul Vann, which to me talks to the insidiousness of what you wrote about. Talk a bit about him, because you do spend some time with him in this book.
Sure. You know, Vann is a very complex individual. Neil Sheehan wrote a fantastic you know, biography of Vann and sort
right.
of a history of the war.
Bright and Shining Lie.
Right, Bright and Shining Lie. And Vann came to Vietnam early. I think it was 1962. He was there as an advisor early on, and he served in Vietnam, you know, on and off in different roles until 1972, when he was killed in a non-combat incident, a helicopter crash. And over the course of the war, I mean, Vann was he was a contrarian who, you know, he was a source for a lot of early reporters like Neil Sheehan and David Halberstam, who saw problems with the war, and Vann was willing to talk about them. But, you know, over the course of Vann's evolution, I think he came to identify with the war so much, and he believed that he was a man who could win this war. And he, you know, when he died, he was the first American civilian in U.S. history to be commanding troops in the field. He had a very strange appointment. By this time, he was the third highest-ranking American in Vietnam. So he's a civilian advisor, but he's commanding American and South Vietnamese troops. And Vann was Vann knew about Speedy Express, and he knew that Newsweek was working on this article, and he was ducking Buckley and Shimkin, and he went back to the Pentagon and talked to Westmoreland about it. Vann had witnessed firsthand the killing in the Mekong Delta, but he wanted to make sure that the story didn't come out, because he thought that the war was you know, winning the war was within reach, and that he was the man to do it. So, you know, he took part in this in the Speedy Express cover up.
There's an interest. What struck me about that, and I was. But you're talking about John Paul Vann. It goes back to almost the insidiousness of the beginning of the war. Can I just share a quote with you from Sheehan's book about Vann?
Sure.
Because it really hit me when I read about Vann in your book. And I was talking to my dear friend Wayne Carlin, who is one of the deans of the Vietnam veteran writers, I think, in America. And he shared this quote with me as we were talking about your book. And Wayne was a helicopter gunner in the Marines. And has been on the show many times, but he wrote, this came from John Paul Vann's book Sheehan's book called A Bright Shining Light. He wrote, before the American troops came, the Viet Cong troops were so intermingled with the peasantry, this is Vann talking, with the peasantry, that Saigon troops had difficulty distinguishing them, friend from foe. Think, Vann said, how much more difficult it would be for Americans. The American soldier would soon see the whole rural population as the enemy. The Army and Marine Corps would create a bloody morass into which they and the Vietnamese peasantry would sink. Quote from Vann again, we'd end up shooting everything, men, women, kids, and the buffaloes. I mean, they knew what they were doing from the beginning. They knew what they were getting into.
Yeah, you know, and Vann wasn't alone. I mean, other Americans who were there early, you know, saw this happening. They saw that the revolution was really inextricable in a lot of ways from the rural population. This was the Vietnamese saw the American War, as they call it, as a continuation of their anti-colonial war against the French, the one that the U.S. had bankrolled during the early 1950s. And you know, the governments of these hamlets were, you know, tied in with the revolution. You know, all the people were. This was, their lives were wrapped up in this, and it was really, you know, it was impossible for the South Vietnamese government. They could never win over this peasantry. So the idea that the Americans would come in, and would somehow be able to do it was farcical, and a lot of people understood that right off the bat. But you know, it just didn't sink in. I think that the war managers in Washington, they couldn't wrap their heads around the fact that the Vietnamese could resist all this American technology, all this war fighting power, and they they just assume that that through the use of firepower, they could somehow break the back of the revolution and separate the people from the nationalist movement. But it was never possible, and the U.S. only ever had one recourse, and that was just to increase the firepower. It never came up with any other ideas. So, and this was ruinous for the Vietnamese people.
Yeah, this great quote in here. In your book, have many of them, but this is the one that popped out from 1968 in Cu Chi, which was a murderous, hellish place for anybody to be. But it was from Major Donald Pierce, and wrote this angry memo you write about what the disproportionate responses in terms of this war. He wrote, to return a few AK-47 rounds with the main gun on an M-48 tank and thus destroy homes and killing sleeping civilians is wrong and is a problem. Any Vietnamese were assumed to be the VC and treated as such, Pierce said, recalled after the war. Troops would always report that they found enemy bunkers, even though we kept telling them that every house had a bunker for protection from fire. Once I sifted through the remains of some houses destroyed in a village on Highway 1 near Trang Bang, I found a grandmother and four children who suffocated from flames. But the guys who they were mostly very decent men who were just drafted into this war or were lifers or men who want to be in the army like he, who just were horrified by the monstrosity of what this war kind of forced upon men to do and were done to people.
Yeah, you know, the American troops were really—I mean, they were ill-trained for fighting anything like this war. They were told, from the beginning of boot camp that basically all Vietnamese were the enemy. They were made to suspect, women and children. They were steeped in these methods of racism and dehumanization In Vietnam, they called it the MGR. That was the acronym, the Mir Gook Rule. The idea was that the Vietnamese weren't really people. They were subhuman, Mir Gooks who could be, killed or abused at will. And I talked to a lot of veterans who told me that, when they got to boot camp, they were told immediately, don't call them Vietnamese. You call them Gooks, Dinks, Slopes, Lance. Anything to take away their humanity. And there are a lot of guys who told me that they knew this was wrong on some level, but you were steeped in it, and that this was just drilled into your head over and over again, and they told you that anybody wearing black pajamas, which this is what they called it, most Vietnamese in the countryside wore this black, loose-fitting clothing.
Right, everybody.
This was guerrillas and farmers alike. And they were told, anyone in black pajamas is a guerrilla. And they learned pretty quickly that there wasn't any problem with just shooting first because no one would ask questions later. So, these are basically young boys. They're 18, 19, 20 years old. They're thrown into this alien environment. The enemy never, fights you toe-to-toe because they're vastly out-armed. They only use booby traps and snipers and ambushes. So you see a glimpse of someone in black running, or you see, someone at a distance. You don't know if they're holding a hoe or they're holding a rifle, but your commanders are demanding a body count, and you're just trying to survive your year and get home. So it makes it very easy to fire, the officers that these American boys are answering to, they're only in their 20s themselves. They're responsible for all these young men. And if you're getting fire from a village, you could send your platoon through there, and they might get chewed up, or you could pull back and call in artillery, and there may be women and children in there, but it's a tough decision for these guys to make, and the military made it very easy by not. By not asking questions about who was getting killed out there, and by accepting any bodies that were toted up as enemy dead.
It's almost like I don't remember the exact quote, but Jean-Paul Sartre said something about at any time a Western country, an industrialized country, fights developing a colonial nation, these atrocities are going to happen. It's the nature of that kind of war.
It certainly seems to, and this use of dehumanization of the enemy is something that if you look back into U.S. military history, you can see it rather plainly that there's a two-tiered system of warfare when the U.S. fights, say, white foes against racial others or ethnic others. From the Indian Wars in the 19th century,
right?
The Philippines insurrection,
right?
In fact, the term "gook" actually comes out of the turn of the 20th century war in the Philippines. They called the Filipino nationalists "gugus," and this transmuted into the word "gook." They ended up the Marines when they went to Haiti and Nicaragua during the early years of the 20th century. They called their foes their "gooks." "Gook" was used again in Korea, and then it returned to Southeast Asia in the war in Vietnam.
And massive atrocities in the Philippines took place, and in Nicaragua. Not documented as well as yours is documented, but and I think that you when you were, they've had all these quotes from so many men who fought in that war, like Air Force Captain Brian Wilson, who you interviewed and talked about what did you write about here in the Delta, that 6,500 tactical airstrikes, 17, almost 1,800 tons of napalm dropped, and his quote was, "It was the epitome of immorality. One of the times I counted bodies after an airstrike, which was always ended with two napalm bombs, which would just fry everything that was left. I counted 62 bodies. In my report, I described them so many women between 15 and 25, and so many children, usually in their mother's arms or very close to them, and so many old people." I can hear him saying it. Let me ask you this question, Nick. What did this book do to you? What did this research do to you?
It might seem strange. There's sort of a counterintuitive answer here.
That's all right.
When I was just using the American records and when I first started working on this project, I found it exceptionally psychologically distressing. It was really tough work. And the Vietnamese in these records were always nameless, faceless victims.
Right.
They were almost always dead. And then I went to Vietnam for the first time, and because I went to try and track down witnesses and survivors from these particular cases, and the Vietnamese changed my outlook in a lot of ways. They changed how I conceived of the project, but also, even though day after day I was hearing the most horrific stories imaginable. These people were telling me about the most traumatic days of their lives, just truly horrible stuff. But somehow afterwards, to see that they had lived through the war, that they'd gone on and lived fulfilling lives and raised families and moved on in some way, I found it exceptionally inspiring. It was just to see the resilience of the people. It made it easier on me in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. to see people who were strong enough to move on even after these horrible circumstances. So, I'm not sure. I know it was tough on them, but in some ways it made it a little easier on me.
One of the most amazing things about the Vietnamese people, we were there in 2005, did the documentary series "Wandering Souls," and was just how forgiving the Vietnamese people are. It blows your mind. They didn't have an ounce of hate in their hearts when they met you. It's really mind blowing. they do change your perspective.
Yeah. I had the same experience. I didn't know what it would be like, the first time that I went to Vietnam. And a lot of times when I rolled into a village, I was way out in these rural areas where they hadn't seen a Westerner, they hadn't seen an American since the war.
Right.
And I might have been the first unarmed Westerner ever to walk through there. They'd only seen armed French and armed Americans in these bills. But I was never met with any kind of animosity, never any kind of anger. And I think maybe as an American, I found it exceptionally shocking because, that certainly isn't the American way. the idea of revenge, I think, is kind of in our DNA in some ways.
It is.
But after I would go through the stories with the Vietnamese and hear all these horrible recollections, I'd find them thanking me and saying that they were amazed that an American knew something about what they'd experienced during the war, that anyone would travel halfway around the world to listen to their stories, and they were uniformly shocked at that, but just so grateful to be able to tell their story. And I don't know that I've ever been able to quite wrap my head around all of it, but it was exceptionally moving and humbling and inspiring in a lot of ways.
I agree completely. I understand, and I one thing we didn't do there is if we have time for two very quick things. We never talked about where the title came from. Kill Anything That Moves. You should tell our listeners that.
Sure. The first place where I really noticed it was the massacre that Jamie Henry blew the whistle on. This was the order from his West Point trained captain. He said, a lieutenant was on the radio with him and said, we've rounded up these people. What do you want me to do with them? And the captain said, you know the operation order that came down this morning. Kill anything that moves. So that, that really, it was sort of burned into my mind. And then I noticed that, I started seeing this phrase in other court-martial testimony and in the recollection of veterans. I noticed that prior to me live, the night before when the men were briefed, Captain Medina, according to subordinates there, told them when he was asked, what should we do with women and children? He said, kill anything that moves.
Mm-hmm.
Then I looked at the court-martial transcript of a Marine Corps massacre from a year earlier, and one of the witnesses there said that their commanding officer said to kill anything that moves. And it seemed like wherever I looked, there was this phrase, and it seemed to be a real shorthand for what the war was about, and I kind of seized on it.
Well, you did very well. I think that your epilogue, where you wrestled with the wandering souls, the wandering ghosts, as you put it in your epilogue, the souls of Vietnam who, if they have no place to rest, will wander forever. That's what this war has done to all of us, and I appreciate your writing this book and taking all this time with our listeners, Nick.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk with you about it. Thanks so much for having me on.
Nick Terse, and the book is Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, which won the Ridenhour Prize for Repertorial Distinction. And Nick Terse is also author of Complex, managing editor of TomDispatch.com, and a fellow at the Nation Institute. And once again, thank you so much, Nick Terse.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.